all of this, of course, as you mentioned, in the frame of the broader budget strategy that is being developed, of course, by the Coalition. Just 7 weeks to go now until that budget is handed down. Let's now go to the National Press Club here in Canberra.
Further ado, I give you Dr. Andrew Leigh.
Well, thanks very much, Mark. Can I begin by acknowledging the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, and thanking the National Press Club for the honour of addressing you for a second time. We politicians come for the chicken, but we stay for the roast. I'd also like to thank my parliamentary colleagues who've joined me today, including Terry Butler, Lisa Chesters, Pat Conroy, Mark Dreyfus, Ed Husic, Claire O'Neill, Melissa Park, and Tim Watts. It's a real honour to serve alongside each of these people. And if you've spoken to them, you'll know that it's impossible to come away from a conversation with any of these individuals and not feel optimistic about the future of the Australian Labor Party. I was proud to stand alongside Bill Shorten and Chris Bowen just a few weeks ago when we announced our package for fair taxation of multinational companies. A fully costed package, grounded in work from the OECD, delivered in the first half of a parliamentary term. You don't see that every day. Our multinational tax package is about ensuring Australia's tax system keeps pace with the global economy. We want to see big multinationals pay their fair share of tax. And we want to see all businesses, big and small, local and international alike, to have a fair chance of succeeding. Because they're competing on a level playing field where the same rules apply to all. And that's why our package targeted debt deduction arrangements, which let big multinationals shrink their tax bills. It's also why we support better information sharing through third-party data matching, and why we'll give the Australian Taxation Office the resources that it needs. Labor's package will see big multinationals pay almost $2 billion more over the forward estimates. Importantly, too, it gets our tax settings right for the long term. I think it says a lot about how seriously Labor's taking that long-term budget challenge, that the first significant policy announcement we've made is a revenue one. But it also demonstrates the approach that we're taking across the board in thinking about new policies for the years ahead. We consulted widely on the details of the package, talked to tax experts in the OECD, had the Parliamentary Budget Office give us their independent, rigorously carried out costings. We're using the years in opposition wisely because we understand that three-word slogans are no basis for governing. And unfortunately, there's some other people up on the Hill who seem to be just learning that lesson now. Identifying future challenges, consulting widely, thinking hard, and coming up with sound, robust policies. That's Labor's approach. And today I want to talk about a different area in which we'll be applying that method, the rise of the sharing economy. When Airbnb founders Brian Chesky and Joe Gabbia were seeking venture capital investment for their online startup in 2009, they took meeting after meeting with no success. As Chesky tells it, one famous investor was drinking a smoothie and just got up and walked out mid-pitch. None of the investors they met with could see value in a website which helped people find spare beds to crash in. And in a last-ditch attempt to get funding, Chesky and Gabbia pitched their idea to the famous Y Combinator startup program in Silicon Valley, run by the IT multimillionaire Paul Graham. Graham didn't much like their idea either. But just as he was about to call time on the meeting, the Airbnb founders mentioned how they'd originally pulled together the cash to start the site. During the 2008 presidential race, they'd bought generic breakfast cereal in bulk and reboxed it in limited edition packaging branded as Obamaro's and Captain McCain's. They travelled around to party conventions, selling the cereal as a collector's item, raising thousands of dollars in the process. Paul Graham later said that Well, he didn't really believe in Airbnb. He believed Chesky and Gebbia had the creativity and drive to run a successful startup. He gave the pair a 3-month residency at Y Combinator and $20,000 to rebuild the Airbnb site. Today, the company is valued at about $10 billion. More than 25 million guests have already stayed at an Airbnb-listed property in one of 34,000 cities across 190 countries. We're getting more and more used to hearing little stories like this. The digital company that came out of nowhere and took the world by storm. The clever idea that turned an industry on its head and made millions in the process. In April last year, UberX launched in Sydney. Less than a year on, 1 in 10 Sydney-siders have used a ride-sharing service. 1 in every 300 Australian dwellings is currently listed on Airbnb. Consider a Sydney-sider who decided to come to my talk today. Before leaving, she might arrange via Airtasker for someone to tidy her garden, drop her cat at a poor shake pet sitter, and pick up the go-get car that she shares with others on the block. On arrival in Canberra, she could rent the car of a local resident using Drive My Car and use Parkhound to find an off-the-streets parking spot, something that's become a little more common since the rise of pay parking in the Parliamentary Triangle. This afternoon, she might check into an Airbnb apartment, use Vailable to take a custom tour of some of Canberra's funkier spots, and then enjoy a privately cooked meal in her home of a chef located via Eat With. Each of the businesses I mentioned have emerged over the past decade thanks to the confluence of fast broadband, ubiquitous smartphones and innovative entrepreneurs. The creativity of people like Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia is changing the way we think about buying and selling goods. Often gathered under the banner of the sharing economy, collaborative consumption or the peer-to-peer market, these app-based services link people who have surplus goods to those who can make use of them. Unlike the kind of sharing your mum encouraged, money generally changes hands in the sharing economy. But the transaction happens directly between the provider and the consumer, with the companies themselves simply offering a platform for bookings and for payments. Sharing economy companies are, first and foremost, tech firms. But they also offer real-world services, which are fast becoming serious competitors to established players in a range of industries. Uber's $40 billion market capitalisation makes it more valuable than Delta Airlines, Hertz or Marriott Hotels. As someone who spends a lot of time thinking about what the economy of the future will look like, I believe there's huge potential in the peer-to-peer market. Australia has a housing affordability crisis, yet there's 9 million spare bedrooms across the nation. Our major cities are in gridlock, yet the vast majority of cars carry only one person. Most people own a power drill, yet the average power drill is used for less than 1 hour a year. Sharing economy services can make a more efficient use of the world's stock of cars, bedrooms, trailers and more. They're a key reason why the fraction of car-free households in San Francisco is rising. Sharing economy services may also create new and more flexible jobs for people who struggle to fit into the traditional labour force, such as students, older people and parents of young children. But I'm not an uncritical cheerleader for this emerging sector. At the moment, many sharing economy services operate outside the rules and regulations which exist to provide and protect public safety, ensure people pay their fair share, and guarantee workers' rights. They're competing with existing providers in the taxi, hotel and other industries which employ hundreds of thousands of Australians, but without being held to the same standards and rules which those providers are bound by. Uber defends its surge pricing model on the basis that it brings more drivers into the market when demand is high. But when surge pricing kicked in during the Martin Place attack, It left many feeling deeply uncomfortable. If you own an apartment in a security-controlled building, you might not feel as secure when your neighbour starts renting out her place on Airbnb. An app like Monkey Parking, which enables people to auction off curbside parking spots, can lead to an upsurge of parking squatters, which is both inefficient and inequitable. Labor wants to see Australians share the benefits of the sharing economy, but we also want to make sure we've got the right rules in place to protect workers, consumers, and the public good. It's a tricky balance, and in a fast-moving digital context, it'll be a challenge to get it right. But we owe it to consumers to take the challenge seriously. Today I want to make clear that Labor supports the innovation and growth opportunities of the sharing economy. Our challenge is to see those services brought within a fair and flexible framework of rules which supports growth without lowering our collective standards. As Claire O'Neill and Tim Watts note in their forthcoming book, Two Futures, we don't believe that technological change sets our society on an unchangeable path. So while there's no doubt we'll see enormous technological innovation in the coming decades, it'll be our values and the decisions we make in response to those changes that'll determine what our society looks like in 2040. At its heart, the question of how we approach the sharing economy is a question about ensuring fair competition in the age of the app. Labor is, and always has been, the party of competition, stretching back to Gough Whitlam's introduction of the Trade Practices Act in 1974. But I don't want to exhaust all of the press club's lunchtime wine supply by taking you back that far. So suffice to say that my party has delivered most of the country's major competition reforms and the major tariff cuts that opened our businesses to global competition. In each case, those reforms were driven by a concern that Australian consumers were getting a raw deal because businesses cosseted from competition had little incentive to work harder, be more innovative, or serve their consumers better. According to the Productivity Commission, Paul Keating's national competition policy led to productivity gains that raised the average Australian household income by $7,000. Over the policy's first 5 years in action. The microeconomic reforms put in place over those years have paid lasting dividends since. When Labor was last in office, we set out to tackle another major obstacle to competition, the regulatory walls between Australia's states and territories. Through the National Partnership Agreement to deliver a seamless national economy, we drove the introduction of a single national regime for fair trading and consumer protection. We also steered significant reforms in areas like transport and infrastructure access, ensuring Australia's states and territories were competing on a level playing field, not one littered with protectionist stumbling blocks. Modelling by the Productivity Commission estimates that just some of those reforms are working to boost GDP by 0.4% a year. We pursued those reforms because Labor believes in helping consumers. Our fundamental test has always been, how can we help Australian families get a better deal? As we look ahead to the type of rules we'll need in an app-based sharing economy, it's a question that will continue to serve as the touchstone for Labor's policy response. From an egalitarian perspective, the sharing economy offers both opportunities and challenges. Right now, one in five Australian households can't afford a holiday away from home once a year. So low-cost services like Airbnb or no-cost services like couchsurfing.com could make the difference between a holiday and no holiday for some Australians. If you can't afford a car, then a carpooling site like Share Your Ride, that's UR in the middle, can make an enormous difference to your mobility. But while the consumer perspective looks rosy, I worry about the equity angle. If you're a banker, a surgeon, or a lawyer, it might seem great to be able to call on casual workers to assemble your furniture, walk your dog, come in and cook a meal in your kitchen when you don't feel like it. But if those jobs are casual and badly paid, the whole arrangement starts to look uncomfortably like a modern restoration of the Downton Abbey era. So finding a balance between promoting the upsides and protecting against the downsides requires us to answer some hard questions about what's important to us as a community. My party doesn't claim to have the answers to those questions. But that's why I'm today releasing a discussion paper that will involve the Australian community in a conversation about what rules we really need to govern the sharing economy. I'll have more to say about how we plan to conduct that conversation in a moment. But first, I want to flag some of the key regulatory challenges the sharing economy raises and the strong principles that will underpin Labor's response. First, workers' rights. The ALP has spent a century and a quarter fighting to protect the rights of workers. We have no intention of giving that vital game away right now. The sharing economy shows just how much the world of work is changing. Instead of working for an employer, we can each become the CEO of our own micro-business. That new autonomy provides great opportunity. But the flip side is it's not always accompanied by the minimum protections, entitlements and standards that are a key feature of a fair society. We don't yet know enough about sharing economy jobs. For example, a US study co-authored by Alan Krueger, one of President Obama's former economic advisers, suggests that US Uber drivers probably earn more than US taxi drivers. But we don't have any similar research for Australia. As a progressive, I'd feel a lot more comfortable if I knew that the sharing economy wasn't merely driving down prices by driving down wages. Embracing peer-to-peer services and a digital economy more broadly will undoubtedly require some adjustments in our thinking about the relationship between employers and workers. But as the Party of Labor, you should have no doubt that my colleagues and I will always make workers' rights a priority. Second, public safety and consumer protections. One of the more interesting aspects of the sharing economy is how these services employ user feedback and rating systems as a form of self-regulation. Lyft drivers and passengers rate each other after every ride. Airbnb visitors leave comments after every stay. Those public feedback channels let consumers make informed choices. Do I stay in the apartment above Berlin's biggest trance club? Shall I accept a ride with the driver who runs red lights while telling me about all of the reasons he loves Tony Abbott? Ratings also offer a way for the companies themselves to monitor the quality of the services being delivered under their brand. Drop below 4.5 stars and you'll struggle to keep your job as an Uber driver. But are reputation-based services enough to keep out the dodgy operators and keep consumers safe? Should leaving negative feedback be the only recourse open to someone who feels their rights or well-being have been compromised? We believe that these public feedback channels are great for building a culture that supports good behaviour in the sharing economy. But we also believe they need to be backed up by reliable external frameworks for when things go wrong. Australian consumers quite reasonably expect they'll be covered by the right kind of insurance if they're injured. They have legal avenues to seek redress if they get ripped off. And that the people from whom they're buying goods or services won't knowingly put them in harm's way. Ensuring those expectations are met within the sharing economy won't necessarily mean extending all the same rules and regulations that apply to traditional operators to the new services. In some cases, different rules might apply because there's different levels of risk. In other cases, there might be an argument for updating the rules for traditional operators and then applying those across the board, so that new and old service providers alike are bound by laws that best reflect the community expectations today. Third issue is accessibility. Australia is a country where we work to break down obstacles for people with disabilities and those facing other forms of disadvantage. That's why we require public buildings like this one, or buildings like this one, to meet accessibility standards. That's why taxi companies have to include wheelchair accessible vehicles in their fleets. I'm concerned there hasn't been enough discussion of access issues in the conversation about the sharing economy. Government has a proper role in addressing the accessibility and equity issues as part of designing fair rules in the sharing economy. Finally, a level playing field. Today, sharing economy services aren't just competing with established players by offering quality services that Australians want. Their rapid growth comes, in part, from their ability to help people with the cost of living. For example, the number one reason people say that they like ride-sharing services is that they're cheaper. Can they still do that if they're bound by a fair set of rules covering the employment, public safety and accessibility issues I've just mentioned? And what about paying their fair share? As Youth Hostels Australia CEO Julian Ledger put it to me, what you call the sharing economy, we call the black economy. But fortunately, I'm yet to meet an advocate who thinks the sharing economy's main value proposition is not paying their share. In general, the sharing economy companies I meet with agree that providers and companies alike should pay their fair share, just like the rest of us. In principle, this makes sense. A car run by Uber or Lyft does the same damage to the road that a taxi does. So it's only fair that it makes the same contribution to the public cost of building and repairing roads. Once we bring sharing economy services inside a framework of rules, there's plenty of companies that will still flourish, but some may find their comparative advantage withers. It's the nature of competition. Labor understands that our goal as policymakers isn't to pick winners by protecting some industries through regulation or letting others gain advantage through a lack of regulation. Our task is to set up a system that promotes fair competition and let consumers decide what best suits their needs. So those are the principles that will underpin Labor's project for a fair and flexible regulatory framework for the sharing economy. We want to protect workers' rights, promote public safety and consumer protections, and improve accessibility and equity while ensuring fair competition. How we translate these principles into a regulatory framework is now up for discussion between our party and the Australian community. The discussion paper I'm launching today, and the copy of which I think Mark has gently removed from the lectern along with his notes, the discussion paper I'm launching today is online. And I'd encourage you to read it and share it, for that matter. We look forward to hearing a broad spectrum of views on the questions that this paper raises. I've already begun consulting with industry groups, companies and other stakeholders to find out what their priorities and concerns are. Some of you have joined us today, and thank you for that. I'm looking forward to having many more of these constructive discussions with people as the work goes ahead. I also want to acknowledge that several of my state and territory Labor colleagues are working on their own local responses to aspects of the sharing economy, including ACT Chief Minister Andrew Barr, Opposition Leader Luke Foley in New South Wales, Transport Minister Stephen Mulligan in South Australia. I particularly look forward to working with state and territory colleagues from all sides of politics on an integrated approach to this challenging new area of regulation. There's one final point worth making about the sharing economy, and it's this. Australian consumers, like those around the world, have embraced these new services with gusto. Whether or not any one company survives, the model of peer-to-peer, app-enabled service delivery clearly resonates. We'd be squibbing our responsibility as policymakers if we simply tried to shut those services down or punted engaging with them off into the too hard basket. A tide that can't be held back should be carefully channelled, and that's what you'll see from Labor. Back in January, I was speaking on ABC Radio in Sydney about the sharing economy. Afterwards, a woman from the outer suburbs of that great city called my office with a story about how hiring out her spare room through Airbnb allowed her to meet her mortgage repayments and stay in the house after a difficult divorce. For her, the service wasn't a techie toy for hipsters. It was a lifeline at a time when she really needed one. Without Airbnb, she might well have lost the house. There may be very real benefits in this emerging economy. Getting the rules right will mean that millions of Australians can share them. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew, for that very illustrative peek into the future and a commentary on the rapidly changing economy as we've seen just in recent years. As usual, we're going to have a series of questions from our working media here today. I might just kick off by asking you a question which goes to that issue of regulation. You say that getting the rules right is going to be very important. It's also going to be very, very challenging because there are so many long-term interests already established in those markets. I'm thinking, for example, in the taxi market, a taxi licence may be an investment of several hundred thousand dollars for people holding those plates, but they're now competing with, theoretically, with people who are not carrying those legacy costs. And I might just say, in my industry, there's a parallel there too with the legacy costs of newspapers, I suppose. So how do you deal with not just the questions of equity and the questions of public safety, but also the embedded economic issues around various sectors of the economy?
Mark, it's a terrific question in terms of the significant investment that people have put in. My philosophical approach to this is the same as people who've occupied this portfolio for Labor governments and oppositions gone by, people like Craig Emerson and Chris Bowen, that our approach to competition should always be about protecting consumers rather than particular competitors. That's as challenging in this area as in any other area. We don't want to entirely discount the investments that people have made, but we do need to make sure that any decisions we're making are in the interests of consumers in the long term. But it's a very live issue. It's one which has come up in a number of the state jurisdictions as they've looked at changes to taxi licensing in general. Victoria's faced this issue square on, and it's one that we're certainly hoping to hear back on through the discussion paper process.
Thanks very much. Next question from Jacob Grieber.
Andrew, excellent speech on a fascinating and difficult topic. I just wonder on the issue of workers' rights and wages, whether some of the concerns you've outlined are a little overstated, given that one of the primary factors in this new economy is that it is a voluntary thing. It's based very much on trust. You gave a number of examples of you know, jobs that have been created that probably don't exist today or didn't exist 6 months ago. Are you know, that's the issue perhaps that goes too far in this if you start to try and regulate things that probably don't even exist yet?
Jacob, it's always easier for economists to identify where job losses will occur than where the new jobs will be created. It's a perennial challenge whether you're someone in my old occupation or my current one. But I do think that the issue of labour standards is important. I'm worried about an environment which creates a set of jobs which don't allow people to get a mortgage, which don't allow them the flexibility to take a holiday, which don't allow them the certainty of being able to get ongoing education. Those things aren't old-fashioned concerns. They're as real today as they were in the more manufacturing and agriculture-dominated Australia of a generation ago. So the way in which we protect working standards may change, the instruments through which we operate may be different, but the fundamental concern of having a well-paid, stable job is one that I certainly don't expect to go away.
David Spears.
David Spears from Sky News. You mentioned towards the end of your speech a woman in Adelaide, I think it was, who after a divorce needed to rent out the spare room on Airbnb as a lifeline. Do you know whether she collected GST or paid GST. I mean, this is a detailed question, but an important one. I've used Airbnb overseas, and I don't recall paying GST or sales tax in the US for it. So what do you think should happen on that?
So, as I said, David, the sharing economy ought to pay their fair share. I certainly see no principled argument why someone providing a good or a service in Australia, which is functionally equivalent to one that's GST paying, shouldn't be responsible for paying GST. Now, there's thresholds for GST, as you know. If you've got a turnover under $75,000, you're not responsible for paying GST. So it's possible that the person who's provided the Airbnb services to you falls within that threshold. But it's also really important that we think about how each of these rules operates. This is no tax grab for extending the remit of the tax system. It's about ensuring we've got a level playing field. And as I said in the speech, when I talk to representatives of these sharing economy firms, that's what they want. They believe they're offering a better product for Australians, not simply a product which is benefiting only because it's making an end run around the tax laws.
Next question from Gareth Hutchins.
Hi, Andrew. The UK government last week responded to an independent review of the sharing economy sector, and the UK Chancellor, George Osborne, said that his government wanted the UK to become the global centre for these sharing economy activities. So, two questions for you, if I may. Would you like policymakers in Australia to draw on some of the UK government's recommendations? And how quickly do you think we need to push ahead with regulation of the sector? Like, will we gain any first mover advantage in the Asian region by pushing ahead with this?
Gareth, you were kind enough to mention to me about 10 minutes before the speech you were going to ask me about this, but my speed reading not being what I'd like it to be, I haven't had a chance to go through the discussion paper. These are certainly big debates that are being had in different parts of the world. Portland, Oregon, struck a deal with Airbnb whereby they agree not to prosecute in exchange for Airbnb services paying what the Portland city thinks are the fair tax rates. New York City's way of addressing Uber was to say that Uber cars and drivers had to fall within their existing regulatory net that applies to taxis. And certainly I'm aware that the people in Britain are looking at how to address the sharing economy. I see this fundamentally as about expanding the goods and services available to Australians. And by doing that, there may well be a spin-off benefit that we encourage Australia as an innovation hub. The person who's been doing more thinking about this than I think anyone else in our party, Ed Husic, who's recently done a trip to the US talking to a range of these technology firms and thinking about how to build those technology industries in Australia. It's important because it's part of the answer to the question that so many constituents will ask me on street corner meetings or forums: where are the jobs of the future coming from? If we muck up the regulatory arrangements, if we create a wild west, or if we over-regulate, then we lose that opportunity to create more of these good jobs and new industries.
The next question from the West Australians, Shane Wright.
Dr. Lee, Shane Wright, the West Australian. I just want to put your Shadow Minister for Competition hat on for a second. And this crosses over into new technologies. Mm. One of the biggest looming issues in terms of the federal budget is Australia Post, given that it's starting to lose money now and will drain the federal budget. They've come up with an idea of slower mail and higher costs, which as an economist, I'm not sure you'll support. But does that mean in your mind that the Labor Party, which pioneered privatisation in this country for many different businesses, has to bite the bullet and say it's time to put the for sale sign out the front of Australia Post?
Shane, we've been engaged with the government on this. It hasn't been one in which we've simply chosen to play cheap populist politics. Jason Clare's been working directly with the Communications Minister on this, trying to think through the challenges that the changes in technology are bringing about on Australia Post. Parcel volumes going through the roof, letter volumes going through the floor. We'll continue to engage, but certainly we don't see asset sales as something that should simply be done in order to find a cheap backdoor way of balancing the budget. We believe that assets ought to remain in public hands if there's a strong public case for it, but the notion that you would just willy-nilly sell off public assets in order to try and better the budget deficit is not one that Labor supports.
John Millard.
Thank you, Mark. John Millard, freelance. Dr. Lee, your predecessor in Fraser, Bob McMullen, was variously a minister in previous Labor governments for the arts, admin services and trade. Some people have suggested that he didn't rise to the ranks of the ministry that his talents undoubtedly deserved. Some people suggested that he wasn't aligned with any particular faction in the Labor Party. Now, you're one of the better qualified economists on the front bench of the Labor Party and currently Shadow Treasurer. Do you think that...
Shadow Assistant Treasurer.
Shadow...
You just promoted him.
Shadow Assistant Treasurer, yeah. Just a slip of the tongue. That perhaps one day you would hope to rise to a higher level within the ministry, even treasurer. Do you think it's likely on talent alone, or do you think it's necessary that you should join a faction?
John, it's a very niche question, but one that I'm certainly grateful for. One of the things about the modern Labor Party is you have people in the left, people in the right, and people who are not aligned. And certainly everything I've seen under Bill Shorten's leadership is that he's interested in having us working as a team and drawing out people's talents and abilities from wherever he finds them. I haven't found a glass ceiling sitting above the independents, and I don't think Alana McTiernan or Nova Peris have either.
Well, that's the thing about glass ceilings, you can see straight through them. Next question from Ken Randall.
Ken Randall from Arcentia, Dr. Lee. Despite the best intentions of what you've said today, wouldn't the development of the sharing industry simply involve the development of another regulatory sector in addition to the one we've got? And it goes back to Mark Kenny's first question. Doesn't that automatically tend to create assets which are valued on the regulatory system? And if I could, let's leave it at that.
Ken, you can certainly go back through history and find firms whose asset values were affected by technological change. There was a significant capital stock in those who owned large forest plantations which grew trees tall enough for sailing ships. The advent of steam destroyed that capital stock, as did the advent of the motor car to people who had large numbers of horses. As a broad principle, I think governments need to be looking to what's going to create greatest consumer value, and that's always been the focus that Labor's taken. You know, it's not an accident when we go back through those competition policy reforms that we find Labor governments spearheading each of them. Fundamentally, our notion is to be on the side of the worker and the consumer, not simply bolstering profits of one firm at the expense of another.
If I could just follow up on that.
Sure.
Isn't, though, the point that you talked about sort of technological change there, change from sailing to steam, for example, and these sorts of things. What I think Ken's question goes to is changes in the regulatory environment, driven by perhaps technology in the sense of the internet, but which leave those assets stranded. I mean, a taxi licence, for example, is only worth what it's worth because of its scarcity value, because of the regulatory environment, you know, attached that value to it. And if we then start allowing other people who haven't had to carry that cost operate taxis effectively, then, you know, someone's licence is basically not worth much, not able to be sold even. So that's the question there. And then I suppose you have perhaps, as Ken's question goes to, the growth through the new system of other regulation-based values?
Mark, I think it's important, but let's not pretend that taxi licence values aren't already falling. Over the last few years, Sydney taxi licences are down. The figure's somewhere buried in the footnotes of my speech. I think it's about 10%. If you look at New York and Chicago, you've had bigger drops still in the value of taxi licences. So these new technologies are already affecting asset values. I think we need to get the regulatory settings right for the future, but certainly part of a reasonable conversation would be how you treat those who, for example, the instance of a widow whose main asset is the taxi licence that her husband left her. Those are reasonable conversations to be had, and they're certainly issues that Victoria and New South Wales have looked at in their specific reviews of the taxi industry.
Thank you. James Kemp.
Recently, the Intergenerational Report attracted quite a lot of negative attention, with even the Treasury Secretary disavowing all knowledge of it. In a couple of years' time, let's say you get that promotion, how would you reform the document to ensure that it better fulfilled its original purpose?
Thanks, James. Well, the Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen, can you all take back the message that I have no designs on Chris's job? I think Chris is doing a fabulous job. Chris spoke in this place ahead of the Intergenerational Report about his fear that Joe Hockey was going to use the Intergenerational Report to play political games. And unfortunately, that was what we saw. We saw a line which said previous policy, which purported to be a Labor policy, but instead was the first budget update brought down by Joe Hockey, including the $9 billion grant to the Reserve Bank and $1 billion given back to multinationals. You've seen the extraordinary case of a group of in the coalition who came to office saying that we should be scared about a debt truck, now saying that a debt aircraft carrier wouldn't be any problem. 50-60% of GDP as debt would be perfectly fine. So that's why when Chris spoke at the National Press Club, he said a Shorten government would put the job of writing the Intergenerational Report in the hands of the Parliamentary Budget Office, would depoliticise this important document and would allow us to have a substantive conversation about those long-term issues. You've really got to look hard through the Intergenerational Report to find discussion of the big challenges for Australia's future: climate change, inequality, innovation, engagement with Asia. Instead, you have this narrow partisan attacks which don't set us up for those big and important conversations.
Can I ask you also about the Intergenerational Report in terms of its 40-year projections? I mean, going back to the earlier comments in your speech, you talked about the exponential growth of these new industries and new services facilitated by the internet. Given that rapid transformation of the economy and perhaps extrapolating that exponential growth, I mean, how can we make any sort of useful projections about what the economy will look like in 10 years, let alone in 40 years?
Yeah, so projection is more art than science. You look at the population projections from successive intergenerational reports, for example. You would have seen this, Mark. You go from the first IGR at the beginning of the noughties to the one at the end of the noughties. You've got a mid-century population projections going from 26 million to 35 million and now going close to 40 million. So what an intergenerational report, I think, is most valuable for is less the precise number that it's projecting and more an opportunity to have those conversations about long-term investments. We know if we're going to be creating more and better jobs in the future, then we need more investment in science. And that means not getting rid of one out of five CSIRO staff and boosting engagement with the scientific communities. We know that in order to create more of those sorts of jobs, then we're going to have to increase our levels of education. And yet we've got an intergenerational report which aims to halve the spending on education by mid-century. So it's the broad policy settings that trouble me the most about the document, rather than the third decimal place of the projections.
Jacob Greener.
Andrew, I wonder if I could ask a quick question. You sort of go back to the skills of your previous occupation as an academic.
This is always dangerous when people preface like this.
And it's partly because you made mention of it in your speech. It's really difficult to get good numbers and modelling on what we're talking about here with this sharing economy. Mm. What's your best guess of how big it might become, perhaps in terms of GDP for an Australia? And secondly, do you see it as a thing that might boost productivity in the long run, or is it something, given the capital destruction that we're perhaps talking about in some instances, would actually be negative for that?
So I think it was Bob Lucas who said the only function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable. And so you should always be very careful in taking advice about the future from a profession that missed the global financial crisis. But I do think there's big potential for creating jobs here. We've seen a rise in the share of workers whose main job is delivering household services. And we've seen certainly evidence that Australians have an appetite for the sorts of products being offered by the two biggest sharing economy companies, Uber and Airbnb. I'm optimistic from both a consumer and a worker's side, but I've been concerned that the federal government has been essentially missing an action in what I think is one of the most important policy conversations for how we generate jobs in the future.
Next question from David Spears.
I want to take you to debt. You referred to the possible debt to GDP ratio of 50 to 60% as a debt aircraft carrier. If that is an aircraft carrier and we're now at about 15% debt to GDP ratio, if that's presumably okay, where should it peak in your view?
David, certainly we need our debt to be on a trajectory of coming back to balance. I'm strongly supportive of that. That's why we made more than $100 billion worth of savings under the previous government. Why, after putting in place fiscal stimulus, we put in place a 2% real spending cap and stuck to that 2% real spending cap. One of the reasons why the previous policy lines look terrifying in the government's documents is that they assume the 2% spending cap comes off. So we will certainly support sensible savings measures. Part of the notion of the multinational tax package wasn't simply to say Labor's up for hard policy conversations, but if you want to add $2 billion to the budget bottom line, here's a Parliamentary Budget Office policy, costed, ready to go. Now, you're going to say that $2 billion doesn't get us back to surplus, and you'd be completely right about that. But what Labor is looking for is a conversation that recognises that the entire community needs to bear some portion of the heavy lifting. And it's a strategic policy choice when you say the first thing you're going to do is to put in place an audit commission which will target spending, and then you kick the can down the road on your tax white paper. Because we know when you focus first on spending, then it's the most vulnerable to bear the pain. And when you look at tax, you're able to find progressive solutions. To take just superannuation, you know, we've got a government which said no to a Labor measure which would have imposed a slightly higher tax rate on people with more than $2 million in their superannuation accounts. That's, I think, the risk of delaying and delaying a tax white paper. And now, effectively, this tax white paper is going to come down too late to be considered for the third budget. So it's a tax white paper which will feed into a pre-election budget. I don't think anyone expects that the Abbott government's, or whoever's government is by then, pre-election budget is going to take on serious tax reform.
Shane Wright.
Dr. Lee, in terms of the sharing economy, apart from company and tax and GST, much of it comes down to the states themselves and state regulation. Do you see that the discussion paper encompasses allowing states to compete in terms of tax rates and in regulation, allowing some states to reduce regulation to encourage startups in that field. And secondly, and I see that the member for Fremantle is here, everyone in Western Australia will know about the West Australian Spud Police, in that in terms of competition, the growing of potatoes is regulated by a quango. As a competition shadow minister, do you think it's time to get rid of the Spud Police in Western Australia?
Shane, I have no strong views on the Western Australian Spud Police. I will leave that to Melissa, who I'm sure can give you an eloquent dissertation on it at the conclusion of today's event. But I do think that it makes sense to not necessarily aspire towards perfect uniformity, but for states and territories to work together to find sensible models of regulating the sharing economy. Australians don't want to race to the bottom, and I don't think there's a strong case for example, to take one issue I raised in the speech, the way in which disability accessible taxis are dealt with in Tasmania to be different from the way it's dealt with in New South Wales. There's a set of common challenges. They're hard. The technologies are coming much faster than regulators are used to keeping up with. And to the extent that we can bring together brain power across the country, I suspect we'll get to better regulatory outcomes. And to the extent that there's commonality across jurisdictions, it will also assist those firms who like to work across borders not to have to deal with eight different types of regulation. A Labor government did this in 1990 with putting in place uniform company laws, and I think that's broadly regarded as a success, as a way of ensuring that companies don't have to spend more time than necessary getting their head around state-by-state company laws.
John Millard.
Dr. Lee, in your academic career, you've made something of a study of the differences between income levels in developed societies and the differences in increasing levels of them. I won't make this mistake again, but when you get into government, what do you think the governments can do about such an increasing level, short of very blunt instruments like transfer of increased taxation or decrease in taxation or distribution of welfare governments? What do you think can be done by governments?
John, inequality is certainly an issue that's close to my heart. Over the last generation, we've seen earnings rise three times as fast for the top tenth as for the bottom tenth. The top 1% share double and the top 0.1% share triple. You've got three Australians with more wealth than the poorest 1 million Australians. So I do think equity is an important issue. One of the things that worries me is that into that environment in which Australian inequality is as high as it's been in three quarters of a century, we've had the most regressive budget in probably three quarters of a century. Cutting back on the sorts of spending which boost opportunities for young people, cutting back on things like the literacy and numeracy coaches who work in some of the most vulnerable schools in the north of Canberra and who create opportunities for children to move out of poverty. I spoke before about the decision on superannuation of the government not to proceed with a slightly higher tax rate on people with more than $2 million in their super accounts. But at the same time as cutting the super taxes on those with more than $2 million in their accounts, they raised the super taxes on those earning less than $37,000 a year. That's fundamentally at odds with the egalitarian Australia, which is not just beloved of Labor members, but also, I think, of all Australians. Our egalitarian story is a great one, and we've got to make sure that those fundamental national values aren't trashed by a set of policies which take from the most vulnerable to give to the most affluent.
Just time for two quick further questions. One from Ken Randall.
Dr. Lee, can I take you back to debt and intergenerational equity? It's not so long ago that it was regarded as just common sense that for long-term infrastructure financing, you borrowed money, often on quite a long term. How did we lose that common agreement And what's it going to take to get it back?
Ken, I think taking a bit of time, allowing the use of debt for long-term financing certainly makes sense. That's a position which would be supported on a bipartisan basis. But you do want to aim towards having the budget broadly back in balance. No. I've been worried when the Treasurer has blown out debt by $80 billion since coming to office. You go back to the last year of Labor, the gap between revenue and spending is 5%. This year it's now 13%. And you've got Peter Costello, who was able to deal with an Asian financial crisis, Wayne Swan, who was able to deal with a global financial crisis, and Joe Hockey telling us he can't deal with a fall in the iron ore price. I don't think that's good enough. I think we need a broad, sensible conversation which brings in conversations about tax expenditures, and which doesn't automatically say that we have to balance the budget on the back of the poorest.
Final question from James Kent.
The Labor Party has been repeatedly pummeled on, well, using the false comparison of the economy with a household budget. Why aren't you cutting through on this issue?
James, it's an issue near and dear to my heart as a former teacher of economics. The household analogy can be useful. If you're making a simple case, such as why might a country take on debt to get through a global financial crisis, you can easily imagine households which, when there's floodwaters rising around them, are willing to put a lifeboat on the credit card. But it does get into problems when households are interrelated to one another. So in a household in a household or a business analogy, you're able to save by paring back costs. Business can boost its bottom line by cutting wages. But it's not the case in an entire economy when your wages flow into consumer spending for my product. When we're all interrelated in that way, then cutting wages simply ends up being a race to the bottom. I think the answer to that, to how we do it, is simple, old-fashioned communication. Paul Keating is the master of the economic metaphor. But also getting away from three-word slogans towards...
A three-word slogan is a three-word slogan, though, isn't it?
A three-word slogan is indeed a three-word slogan. But... Thinking about the appropriate metaphors, I remember Keating talking about flexible exchange rates as a shock absorber for the Australian economy. We need to be clear in our communication about the importance of long-term investment. The notion that, yes, debt and demographics matter, but so does engagement with Asia and innovation. And what I've been trying to do today is to talk about a piece of that innovation puzzle, which is ultimately as important to our future prosperity as any other challenge that we're facing as policymakers today.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I ask you to put your hands together for Labor's Shadow Assistant?
Thanks.
That's where we'll leave the National Press Club for today. The Shadow Assistant Treasurer Andrew Lee, you heard him there outlining in particular a discussion paper on the shared economy, talking plenty about things such as Uber, for example, Airbnb as well. We've ticked over, though, to 1:30, Australian Eastern Daylight.